I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So we say welcome to this CSR pod in collaboration with the Sustainability Business Day in Stockholm 2015. And especially welcome to Christelle Delby from Vodafone. You are Group Head of Sustainability for Enterprise. Very welcome.
Thank you. And I have a qualified guest to begin with. You are born in France, you're educated in England, and you got a master's from Sweden. Is that correct?
You've done your research very, very well.
That's great. And you studied the master's program, the IIIEE program in Lund. How did you find it and how was it?
How did I find the master's or yes. how did you enjoy it?
Well, first, how did you find it? Because it's kind of against all odds to be born in France, studied in England, and then go to Sweden.
It's a very, very good question. So I was in my early 20s, and one summer I had to spend the summer in Gothenburg because my boyfriend at the time, he was Swedish, was spending the summer there. He was working, so I was very bored. So I thought, rather than not do anything with my time, I'll go and do something. So I decided to go and volunteer for Greenpeace in Gothenburg, and this was the best thing I think I've ever done. So I supported a number of projects, met a number of very passionate people, and it is then I think I realized I wanted to do something in this space. I wanted to not just have a job that pays me at the end of the month, but wanted to do a job that gave me a sense of purpose. And very luckily, one of the person working at Greenpeace in Gothenburg mentioned that the Swedish government was just creating a master's degree in environmental management and policy at the University of Lund, and that the masters were sponsored by the Swedish government, and that they were inviting students from all over the world, and I could of course apply. So I did, and I was the only French person in the first batch of this master's degree. So this is how it all happened.
So how was it then? How was studying in first class, first year in Lund? And that's interesting.
Very, very exciting. The best thing I think I've ever done. First of all, because of the cultural diversity of the program. So we were 30 students and we had 25 different nationalities in the 30 people. I mean, this was like a tour of Babylon, you know. It was just absolutely amazing. So that was great. What was great is that it was innovative, so it was the first program of its kind. So the directors and the lecturers were finding their feet as much as we were. So that was very exciting. So we had a chance to feedback and help create the program of the future. And I think for me personally, being in Sweden as well. So I'm a big fan of Scandinavian countries. Mm. And it was very exciting to study abroad and be in Scandinavia and be in Sweden. So
what is so inspiring about Sweden and the Scandinavian countries then? I mean, from curiosity, so we're the Swedish people. We don't see any advantages of ourselves.
You're only 2 hours by flight from the UK, but you have a very strong identity in terms of your country, your culture, the values you believe in, the way you go about doing things. That's actually very, for me, very exotic. Mm. You know, I think it's as much exoticism in Sweden as there is going to Kenya for me, yes, in a very yes, different way. Yes. So you are very different. And there is a certain pragmatism about Swedes that I think is wonderful. There is a certain closeness to nature, which I think is absolutely amazing. It always struck me that in Sweden the environmental piece or the social piece is a given. It's not to be debated, it just is. And you just have to find a way of how to do it. It's the how, not the whether or. And that was very refreshing and a fantastic place to do a master's in that kind of environment.
So would you recommend it to some, to others?
I would sell spending a year in Sweden to anyone. anyone who wants to hear me. Absolutely.
Lovely. Lovely. Okay.
So after your education, you had a couple of years of consultancy.
That's correct.
Right?
That's
and,
right,
and,
yeah.
And how did you enjoy that role?
So my first, yes, absolutely. So I had the great pleasure to join a very famous consultancy in the UK called Sustainability, with a capital A in the middle. And this was an amazing opportunity again, because this consultancy was a consultancy, but yet acting as an NGO, a little bit of a hybrid. So they had a relationship with corporations, delivering project for them at a price, but they were also doing publication, challenging corporations to behave differently. So there's this kind of dual purpose, you know, half consultancy and half advocacy piece that was very interesting. And I now work for a very inspiring man called John Elkington, who is the chairman and founder of Sustainability. And this was a great honor and a great way to start in the field.
And then you started in the telecom business in 2002. Mm-hmm. And you have been there in 14 years now. If you look back, how has the telecom market changed for a large operator?
So it has changed a great deal. 14 years. That doesn't sound.
We didn't want to remind you.
No, thank you. That is not what I need to hear. I remember, so when I first joined the telecom industry, so I've changed companies. I've done two companies in that space of time. At the time, we were advocating change when it comes to something called conflict minerals. The certain minerals that go in mobile phones that get sourced mainly in the Congo, a mineral called coltan. And at the time, this was a very lonely battle of the sustainability people within the organization saying, we must do something about this, because it's fueling civil war, it's destroying the livelihood of orangutans in DRC, and we've got to do something about it. And it was a very lonely conflict, very lonely battle that we had with our own business. And now actually this conflict mineral piece has been legislated for in the States. Mm. So actually it's about implementing policies inside a business to be compliant. It makes it quite boring actually, but at least it's something is happening. So that's one of the things that I've seen happen. One of the other things, I mean, at the time, a few years ago, it was more about, I would say, things like carbon. And it's still about carbon, because we have a strong, very big carbon footprint, which is getting worse, because the more advanced mobile phones are, the more the network needs to be powerful to support that. But now it's become much more complex in a way to manage. It's issues around privacy, freedom of expression, safe use of mobile phones. So it's much more about the user end, and the solutions are much more diffuse. And there isn't a simple answer, does it? So, you know, engineers can look at a mobile mast and look at how efficient they can turn it in terms of engineering. But when it comes to human rights and different cultures and what's acceptable, not acceptable, that becomes actually far more interesting in my mind. And also what has changed, and that's really close to my heart, is it's not sustainability in the telecom industry is not just about mitigating the negative impact that we have, you know, lessening the bad. It's about how we can use mobile technology and data and communication as a force for good. And that's a piece that I'm particularly really excited about. So it's how can we use mobile to really transform healthcare in emerging market? How we can use mobile to make education system more efficient in South Africa, Kenya, Mozambique? It's how can we use mobile to enable worker consultation in factories in China, the people manufacture our own handset, you know, allowing us to ask them, you know, how they're being treated directly. So it's a whole new, it's that innovation piece, which I think is there now, that actually wasn't there when I started in the telecoms.
How are you staffing the sustainability team in Vodafone? Do you have a sustainability manager in each country, or?
So yes, we have. So we have 20 different local markets, and in each of those markets, there are representative who are their liaison partners with the headquarters. But it is up to each local market to decide, you know, how many they need and what they do, and because they have to make it. We're very, very strong in our culture in terms of local power and local decision making.
And actually in Sweden we don't have Vodafone anymore. It's called Telenor.
Telenor. So we don't have what we call footprint in Sweden, but we have partners. So we would serve some of your enterprise customers in partnership with local telecom operators. So that's what we would do. Absolutely. So I couldn't justify to be here on the basis of our Vodafone footprint. It's more from, I would say, sentimental reasons.
Coming back to Sweden.
Where is the sustainability function hosted in the organization? Is it in each country? What's that what you said?
Or? So it's in each country as well as headquarters. We are based in London. And in London, we act as we're a very light function. Because the way we operate is we work with various functions like the terminals people and the technology people and the consumer people, the marketing people. And we basically ensure, we work with them over time to ensure that they have their own sustainability lead in their functions. So for example, in our function called supply chain, we have now sustainability lead specialist in that supply chain function, who is actually taking the charge of any sustainability-related issues for supply chain. And he does a fabulous job. So I think it sounds a bit of an excuse for a smaller team, but our business really see our success as being as small team as possible, centrally, and as many people as possible in the operating market, as well as a function, because this is where the real work happens.
Does that mean that it's only you, or do you share your kind of function with?
Absolutely not. So to explain, I'm head of sustainability for enterprise. So I'm head of sustainability, but I'm not. I've got a specialist focused. My job is to focus on enterprise businesses. So Vodafone has for enterprise customers. They have customers like Skanska, who's here today, who I spoke to, Unilever, Nestle, Diageo, IKEA, all those guys are our customers globally. And what I do is I engage with those enterprise customers to look at how we can use our technology to address the sustainable growth challenges. That's what I focus on. So we have the rest of the team focuses on environment. We have somebody working on electromagnetic field. We have somebody working on more like human rights and freedom of expression. And we have the people doing the foundation work as well, which is very separate from sustainability matters. So there is a bigger team out there. But my job is specialist within that team, if that makes sense.
I need to try to kill a prejudice and say this is my kind of, we all have our crusades.
And we like
my,
it.
Yeah, on. One of my crusades is that, when we heard it today a million times already, people say, if you don't have the CEO on board, nothing is ever going to happen. It needs to be positioned with the CEO, otherwise it won't happen. And I don't believe that's true. That's my crusade. I think that's an illusion. I think there are many good things happening without the CEO ever having a clue. Would you kind of join me in my crusade, or would you say, no, it's really true? You need your board, and you need the CEOs and the kind of top people to be on board.
So yes and no. I think taking the example of Vodafone, Vodafone has achieved a lot without our CEO being vocal. I would say our CEO is very supportive, but he's not one of the CEOs that will stand on the platform and bang on about sustainability as a standalone topic. But he is very supportive. Mm. And what he believes in, most of all, and that's really important, is that sustainability is not a side topic. It's about, it needs to be integral to the business. He's really, really passionate about this. It can't be, you know, it can't be business here and then sustainable reporting or anything on the side. He really wants the two to merge together, which is quite confusing for some because they think, oh, he's not really pro-sustainability, but he is, he truly is. So to go back to your question, it can happen without the CEO being vocal about it, but it does help to have senior people, you know, pushing the agenda forward. So for example, we have a lady called Serpil who is leading all our Asia, Middle East and Africa activity for the business from the executive team. And she is a very strong advocate of anything around women empowerment, sustainability related, innovation. And actually, whenever she gets onto an agenda, things will just happen. So you've got to learn to find those people as well. But it doesn't have to be just a CEO. You've got to work with what you've got.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for commenting that. So rather going into the grey area where I live when you find the right people. You were mentioning before that the force for good and driving the innovation of telecommunication. And you were mentioning, you know, some of the examples. But could you choose one of your favorite stories and explain to people why telecommunication can actually really be a force for good? And, you know, give us the tale of what does it actually do? Because I think some people hear it, but don't completely understand it. What?
I often get that question. People will, you know, beyond the jargon, what exactly, what exactly are we talking about? So it's, I've got some very, very concrete example for you. One of them is a project that I visited in South Africa. I went to a province called KwaZulu-Natal, which is a short flight from Johannesburg, is on the sea. And I went to see a primary healthcare centre. So it's a healthcare centre which are right at the bottom of the healthcare system. And it was completely crowded, people waiting in, you know, in meeting room for ages, and there were doctors there and everything. And it looked fairly organised, quite busy, but well organised. And actually, the key issue there was availability of drugs. So it was very likely that those people would travel for a whole day, 2 hours, whatever it is, spend money on a bus to get there. And they'll be seen by a doctor and they'll be correctly diagnosed, but they wouldn't get, it's like, oh, sorry, but you know, to treat that disease, we need three drugs and we've only got one out of the three. And the issue there is not that the government doesn't have the money to supply the drugs. That is not the case. What the problem is with the situation is that the stock are badly managed. It's logistics, pure business logistics, practical thing. So how does that relate to us is probably the question that's coming to your mind. Well, very simply, because we've worked with the Ministry of Health to do a mobile stock taking system where the nurses, a designated nurse in that healthcare center, basically does a stock management, a record of how many of which medicine is left in the cupboard every week on a set day. And that data gets sent to a centralized platform. We then can predict when which drug needs to be resent to that center and when, rather than the old system was, they would wait until it would, you know, run out and then fill in a paper form that would sit there for ages and then be sent through whatever means, and then it'd take another 3 weeks to deliver. Mm. Now we know that, you know, when there's 10 left or 20 left or 30 left, now it's time to trigger the order again. And that is so simple. I mean, it's absolutely amazingly simple, but it's completely changed. Our stock management for drugs is being done. And I know that we've trialed on KwaZulu-Natal and the Ministry of Health loves it so much, they want to use this as a as a excellent center for the rest of the country. They want it absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, and then and then mobile telephony is the crucial thing as well, of not being, you know, you don't have to be locally connected. It's not as costly.
It's not that mobile. It's not that costly, and it means that it can be done at any point. The nurse can go into the stockroom with the mobile. It's very simple to use.
It's cheap.
It's cheap. It's very, very cheap, and it's a tool that everybody is very comfortable with.
Yeah.
So even with the smaller healthcare centers, which may not have a computer system and may not be linked, they can use that mobile. Very, very cheap. Mm. Very simple.
See, I'm showing my color now as being a mobile phone engaged, committed person. But if we flip the coin of communication and mobile communication now, you know, changing basically how we live and how we act, we can also see that young kids today has been using the mobile phone and reaching internet in another degree. And I looked into research saying that in 2013, 53% of the 9 to 12 years old had daily use of internet through the mobile phone. And the number for 13 to 16 years old is 88%. We're reaching a degree where very young kids can reach anything online, and they're spending their whole time doing it.
Yeah.
So we're touching on an addiction. And, you know, is that sustainability for Vodafone? Is that something you're dealing with or talking about?
So you've got two heads here looking at you. You've got the Christelle working for Vodafone, who's actually a fairly proactive company on that front. And you've got the Christelle being a mother of two children, who's 6 and 9. So it's interesting because as a Christelle for Vodafone, and before I used to work for Orange, I had a very theoretical, academic view of those issues. You know, I worked when I was at Orange. We were the first to produce a pamphlet, like a booklet for parents, for responsible use of mobile phone, to educate parents about the things they need to look out for. But that's interesting because I thought, you know, that was amazing and we did so well. But actually, it didn't really sink in at a very personal level. And it recently did with my two girls who were 6 and 9 when they've been given a secondhand iPhones. We're not connected to the network, but they're connected to Wi-Fi. And I found that my youngest was filming herself doing instruction videos of Play-Doh and Barbies, and then came to my husband and said, "Can you just put that on YouTube, will you?" Mm. And that's really scary because she's one step away being connected to Wi-Fi to actually posting on a video, and she's 6. Mm. So I totally get our customers being nervous, and I think it's most of the time because parents are behind their kids.
True.
So we feel like we can't control because we're behind. So this is not necessarily Vodafone answer, but it is also a Vodafone answer. And the key is in providing the information for free choice, for informed choices. So for example, with my girls, what I will say to them is, okay, first of all, they have to ask when to use a device. So that I want the number of hours I spend on a device to be controlled. But once they're on there, I make them responsible of their own learning in a way. I told them that there might be things which are scary and feel wrong, but they should speak up about it. And the dialogue is a very important part of it. And I think that's what's important. And believing in the nanny state where, you know, if filters on their own is not going to sort everything. And it would be wrong to give parents just filters and say, you use that and you're just fine. That's
because
not
you
right.
are providing filters.
We are providing filters, and it's one part of the answer. As long as parents don't think, yeah, I've done my bit, everything is okay, everything's safe, I don't need to be a parent anymore. So I think nothing will replace dialogue and common sense. And it is difficult to find the right balance. Mm. It is difficult. But I saw something recently on the internet with regard to some studies about the maximum number of hours that should be given to children of different ages on various different devices, because it's not just mobile these days. Mm. It's a mobile, it's the iPad, it's television on demand. it's the Nintendo. It's there are so many screen times with different drawbacks. And how, as a parent, do you legislate for that? Becomes an absolute minefield.
Yeah, and how do you actually dialogue about it? Because it's up to everybody, but it's still a shared problem. And I was also thinking about bullying and social harassment and those things that were done on the play yard or, you know, schoolyard. But they're also entering internet and they're becoming a public, going into the public domain, and the scale of them can become so much bigger. So how do we dialogue about those things as a, you know, responsible behavior, shared responsibility between operators and parents and children? And
so again, for the operators, I think there's a number of things that can be done, making information available through the web, even though the parents really have to know that it's there, through our shops. When I was in my previous job at Orange, we did a fantastic piece of work with teachers. We did some videos, some really cool videos with some bespoke. We chose a band, a music band, to create some tunes to go with those videos. And we created some scenarios with some youngsters about teaching, not about teaching, because as soon as you get into that teaching mode, the kids will shut down and they'll think, you're just old and boring, and you can tell me what to do and what not to do. And they shut down and they don't listen anymore. No, we just told stories. We did little story, almost little episode. And one of the episodes was a story of this girl who had been on the internet and had been bullying someone really badly through Facebook. And she was going for an interview for a job in a clothes shop at the weekend. And basically the employer who was interviewing her had in front of her, not her CV, but she had a trace of what she'd been saying and doing on the internet. So that was her CV, basically, that was being followed. So she was being questioned about the language and the abuse that she'd given to that other girl. And of course, you can imagine she didn't get the job. Mm. So suddenly, that was a different way of teaching children, actually, for your own self, you know, interest, not a good idea. But not patronizing them from, it's bad to do it, you know, you mustn't do it, otherwise you'll be punished, because that's not going to sink in. So it's a different way of engaging. So there's different ways to get through the parents, but also through the schools. So different channels.
You share an approach with many other companies today, and that is that you work closely with the stakeholders to define your key issues. Mm-hmm. And you use actually a materially matrix.
Mm-hmm. It's quite hard.
Yeah.
Materiality matrix, yes.
Could you tell us a little more about that? How does it work?
So how does it work? So on a yearly basis, we try to reflect on, it's an internal exercise. Obviously, the sustainability team engages with a range of stakeholders and a range of issues, and we try to have an internal debate about how those issues have evolved. So it's not a scientifically, you know, exact tool. And I think what's not interesting is where the issue sits on the matrix, but it's a movement of that issue from one year to the other. So we can have internal conversation about, for example, privacy and human rights and freedom of expression becoming higher on the agenda, because we've engaged NGOs on a proactive basis, because we've had issues in the marketplace about it for a number of reasons. So it's not a scientific tool, it's more of a...
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Internal reflection, forward-looking tool, I would say, yeah.
Okay. Who's part of the reflection then, the yearly reflection?
So
trying to pull out kind of tips to the people how to work with the matrix
so
like that.
The sustainability team engages on a regular basis with various functions in the business. So before we used to do it just between ourselves, but then what we did is we did a first draft as a materiality matrix, and then shared it with our various point of contact in the functions to ensure that, to do a bit of sanity checking about whether, you know, they had the same view. And you have interesting debate because obviously each of those functions tend to think that their issues are more important than everybody else's issues, as you can imagine. But it's interesting to have that, you know, get their input as well, of course.
And would you also kind of have a stakeholder dialogue outside the company as well on an annual basis? Or would that be, you know, part of the ongoing relationship?
So it's interesting. I had this question on the panel today, and my first answer to this was businesses have always done stakeholder engagement. So this idea of the sustainability team being in charge solely of stakeholder engagement is for me, you know,
absurd.
Completely absurd. I've been there, done that, and I think, well, that's a little bit naive. I think so. The first thing is to ensure that the dialogue that exists already is not wooden and not too narrow. So, for example, when you engage with the enterprise customers, it's important that you're not just talking about, okay, how many mobiles do they want, how many minutes for how many employees, but you start talking about their sustainability pain points, how we can help them and innovate with them. How we can offer, you know, maybe a buyback and recycling system for their handset, things like that. So it's not just about the traditional commercial points. So I think that's the first one. And I think when it comes to new stakeholder engagement, yes, the sustainability team is useful when there are specific issues. So, for example, when we faced issues in Egypt, there was a revolution, and we were heavily criticized by NGOs for shutting down the network. But the government asked us to. And you know what? We only have a license to operate there because the government gave us a license. So it was very hard for the NGOs to understand what it was like to be operating in Egypt at the time. And the fact that we actually acted in the best interest of our employees to defend them, and we did the best that we could. So with those particular NGOs, there needs to be a specific dialogue, which is about a specific issue. So we organize a trip to Egypt where we made them meet the CEO, the people that work in the shop, interview some customers, to just let them feel the reality on the ground. So that would be a bespoke dialogue that we organized because it was required, and we were the most credible neutral point in the company to do so, because we didn't have a commercial, you know, a direct commercial interest to, you know, to lead the conversation one way or the other. But generally it's more about changing the content of the stakeholder dialogue that already exists rather than coming up a whole new a whole new stakeholder dialogue set up.
That's what I understood you saying on the stage as well. We've always been talking to our stakeholders, but the content of what we're talking about is different. But aren't there stakeholders which you as a sustainability team would see as being more important, or maybe stakeholders that from commercial basis wouldn't be seen I'm thinking about what we talked about now, like the right of the children, of looking at from a child perspective. Maybe that what's I'm trying to find, are there kind of stakeholders that you on the sustainability team would say these are important, while the, you know, the usual commercial communication with the customers would see differently on?
So I guess it's issues, it can be issues led. So for example, on tax, which is an issue that came up on the panel from my colleague from Hand in Hand. We were heavily criticized on tax, and we took the decision to really go all out and go forward with transparent reporting, country by country, tax by tax, every single level of tax that we could pay, and exposing where there were gaps and where we were really low, really high. And in doing so, we did some engagement with some NGOs to ask them for their input. So that we did.
That would be a specific group, though.
Because that's very specific. So as a result of the Egypt situation, what we now have is something called the industry dialogue, where we are basically dialoguing. We've got a group with all the other network operators as well as other internet players who may be subject to the same requests from the governments that we have. And we basically work together to come up with a charter of what we should all agree to do when we get asked to do things that we don't think are right in terms of human rights, but which we have to do because legally we have to. So for example, in that one, very practically, we agree that if we get asked to do things like switch off the network or disseminate information through our network, yes, we will do so. But the condition is that we will publish the name on the internet of the person who's asked us to do that from the government. And we will publish a notice saying, you know, we've been asked by this guy to do this, and this is what's happening on that date. And you will all receive the text message saying this.
Did you do that in the Egypt case?
No, because the Egypt case was when we did basically our learning. And I say again, yeah. we didn't do anything wrong. We've acted in the best possible way. But in terms of human rights, we understand why some people are, I angered by it, but we had no choice, otherwise our people would have lost their lives. But there is one country, I won't name the country, where a very similar situation happened. Things were heating up and we were asked by the government to basically shut down the network to stop people communicating with one another, to rebel and to organize demonstrations. And we put the plan into action and the problem went away.
That's brilliant.
But that's not the kind of thing that we can shout about, as you can imagine. Yeah. And I have to avoid mentioning the name of that country. But it's secretly, within the sustainability team, we were absolutely ecstatic because it's the best non-visible, non-shouty success that you can have that you never put in your sustainability report. But it's a very powerful one.
Wouldn't you be able to publish it but not mentioning the name like you're doing right now and actually say these are the cases that we had? Because it is an interesting, and we're getting into a grey area where information flow, needs to happen. But, the evaluation that you're doing could teach us quite a lot.
People could easily, I think, deduct.
Yeah.
Looking at the countries where we operate, and then looking at, in that financial year, where political troubles happened, they could probably find out. Yeah. And obviously we have governments are stakeholders and we need to respect as well. So we want them to do the right thing, but we don't want to humiliate them. You can imagine in terms of stakeholder trust, the damage this would do if we went public with this kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, unless you had a shared commitment among all the operators saying this is our policy of doing it.
This is it. We work with the other operators to agree to the same
standards.
So we all stick together and think we will stand strong, because if one operator refuses to do it and the other says, fine, it's free game, then it's not going to go very far. But I think the next frontier is to get the government to sign up for it.
True.
We need to get them to agree to say, okay, this is, those are the rules of the game. But obviously they give us a license.
Because
they control us.
I think George Kell kind of pointing out transparency is the, one of the driving forces behind CSR. And I sometimes feel that we're talking so much about transparency. But then even if I'm kind of would claim to be somewhat professional on sustainability and CSR, me reading lots of these reports doesn't actually tell me anything as of yet. And if you start tracing stuff down to detail, you get so little information.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the urge to go public with these things and actually get the governments to agree on, yes, let's have a transparent agreement and have people have opinions about it.
Mm.
I mean, I know I'm sounding slightly naive, but
I think
good idea.
I think the day that we have a government officially signing up to this, to our rules of the game, then yes, it will be worse. You know, communicating, then it would be completely fine. What we've done in the case of that country is to use the tool behind the scene to influence an outcome. But obviously we can never be too open about having done so.
Mm.
So it's an internal little secret victory of ours.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good
for the
victory.
Moment,
it's a very
for,
good victory.
For the moment, we can't shout.
Yeah.
One thing that I guess you haven't discussed so much with your stakeholders is, does the common consumer really grasp the degree of information that you have as an operator on him or her?
So I think it's a very, 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 very good question. One which is at the heart of our business, really, because increasingly, what's becoming interesting about business model is not it's not so much going to be about talk time on the mobile phone. The future is all about big data.
And it's a goldmine for you as a large operator.
And it's a potential goldmine, which if we miss out on it, you know, it would be a big mistake. However, and this is where I'm actually really proud of the company I work for, we want to do it right. Not just because it's ethical and it's the right thing to do, but because it's in our best commercial interest to do it right. Because we know that we can't fool customers. We know that we can't operate despite them. So there is a team in the business who runs what's called the, and it's just, the, I would say, looking at the age of the company, just at the its infancy, is a permission and preferences program. So customers appreciate receiving information that is relevant for them. That's one. However, they do not want to feel like their data is being taken away from them without them knowing. So it's a fine balance, and it's a great commercial opportunity for us as well. So what the business is going for is a permission and preferences program where the customers is put in a driving seat and he's making all the choices. So they're defining a number of, let's say, not triggers, a number of different things that customer could say yes or no to, going from, maybe their browser, where they browse the internet, being looked at, so we know the kind of stuff they're interested in, whether they want to receive emails, advertising emails or not. So it's all about putting them in a driving seat and giving them all the decisions. So if they want to say absolutely no to everything, which, for example, I know my parents would do, they would say, I just want nothing from you.
Mm.
Just the least I get, the better. Then that's fine. We're in a position with technology to respect that. But obviously there's some youngsters who, if they're doing windsurfing, would love to receive emails about the latest windsurfing competition or windsurfing products or whatever. And that's fine, because that suits their expectation of what their privacy line works or not.
I'm thinking to myself that we're talking about stakeholders being a very important part of the sustainability agenda and stakeholders involved in defining what is the most important thing or not the most important thing for us to do. But my feeling is that when it comes to this big data and when it comes to integrity, we're not having, the awareness level amongst the customers of today is not that high on understanding what you actually got, that gold mine that we talked about. Do you think people see it as
well? This is why with this program, we want to come forward as a customer and put out all those choices clear to them. So they know exactly, and they press the button that they want to press, and switch off everything else.
But would you agree that the debate about integrity and the insight to what big data actually means, do you think that's a public debate today? Because what you're actually doing is that you're giving a stakeholder a choice which they may not be aware of them having yet, as of yet. They don't reflect on you understanding what they've kind of surfed and, you know, who they called and where they've been and all that.
Well, that's partly because of that lack of knowledge that they have at the moment, which then lead on to fears, which is sometimes unfounded and sometimes founded.
Are we at the stage of fear today? Do you think
Absolutely.
Okay, people are kind of aware
and they don't really understand the detail. But they are very fearful and very defensive. Majority of people defensive of their privacy. So some countries are more fearful than others. So for example, Germany. You've been to Germany, and that is a no-go zone.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that anyone can have access to your information is absolutely unacceptable, even if it's anonymized. So, I mean, to give you an example of where, you know, anonymized mobile data can be super helpful. So, for example, we can one of the things that we can offer enterprise is by monitoring in an anonymized way who enters a building. You understand the occupancy of a building. So you're able to see which part of your building are best used or not used, so that the facilities people can decide, okay, this building is costing us that much, but, you know, the traffic is not that good, it's not that great, the occupancy is not great, so we could just maybe rationalize how many buildings we have. And this is a great use because it leads to more efficiency. And it's anonymized, so we're not looking at Airbnb-specific data. But I use that example with a customer in Germany, and they reacted very strongly to this. Even if the data is anonymized, if any of our employees know that we're tracking their mobile phone to see the movement of people within the building, they would be furious.
Yeah.
So we did it ourselves on our HQ in Newbury, in near London, about an hour from London. And we wanted to see how many people were actually using the building, each part of the campus. So we can see on a map basically one person is one mobile, and we can track, you know, how many people at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock. We can see that how much is being used on a Friday, how much is being on a Tuesday. We can see, you know, so that we can hopefully organize things differently and give different policies in terms of working from home or whatever. And some people didn't react very well. Even though the information is completely anonymized, we're not looking. But people sometimes think, well, am I being tracked? Are they going to check whether I've actually come in on time, like in a factory where you put your card to check in?
And your know-how should be quite high compared to the kind of general user in that area. So you're saying that in some countries a big issue, in some countries it might not be a big issue or debate.
So in France and Germany, for example, people are much more defensive of their
privacy,
this personal space.
Is there a difference between the generations? I mean, do older people react more than the young people or opposite?
Oh, that's a good question.
You haven't seen the...
That's a very, very good question. I would tend to think that older generation are more protective.
On the other hand, they are less aware than the
But they are
people.
Less aware.
Yeah.
And the younger generation is probably more weary, probably because they know more as well. Mm. So I actually don't know. So it's a good question. I wouldn't want to generalize and fall into cliches by answering that question. Mm. I'm not really sure.
When entering into a contract with an operator, and we have also sounds, we're just giving out on sounds, aren't we?
We can say that we are in the end of the sustainability business day, so that's where all the sound comes in.
And Torbjörn can't hunt everybody down, so
no.
We'll just keep on talking instead. When entering into a relationship with an operator, as of today, it's a very often a mixed contract. You would provide telecommunication, but you would also provide the handset.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it would be this kind of the drive of getting new phones annually, and, you know, you would not stop using it because it breaks down. You would stop using it because you have a new offer. You can't even, I mean, I try to call my operator and say, we as a, I used to run an offer with lots of consultants and said, we don't want to join your deal of having new phone because we're happy with the old ones. And they said, oh, you have to get them. I said, I don't want them, but okay, you have to get them because it's in your contract. So, I mean, the connection between the operator deal and the hardware is that, you know, that's happening.
I'm actually very surprised that your operator would force you to switch to your mobile phone.
They did. Because they made us go and get them and said, you know, you need to get them because it's in your contract. And we said, okay, fine, we'll get them. Well, we won't use them, but, you know, we'll store them until they're broken, the other ones are broken.
That is extraordinary because they usually would be very happy to let you carry on out of contract on the same old handset because
yeah, Telia for you.
That's an interesting tactic. I mean, there are at least in the UK offers which are separate the communication from the handset. So we have what's called a SIM-only tariff, where basically you can and there the tariff is very advantageous. You know, like very much cheaper than any other tariffs, where you basically turn up with any handset and we basically provide you a SIM and then off you go. Mm. You know, because the industry got in the habit of basically giving subsidized handset, that's why we have to lock people in.
Yeah.
Because it takes 10 months, 12 months to break even with the communication that you're giving us every month, the fees that you're giving us every month to break even on the price of the handset. So we only start making money after X number of months, depending on the handset. Yeah.
That was a successful business model at the time. But talking about business model and sustainability, we think that some of the changes in sustainable world will be the business model. And this is obviously a negative business model because the tying in...
It is. And it's one which we deplore as well. So we in a way created a bad habit in the market many years ago when we first started. This is only maybe Christelle speaking. I don't know if Vodafone would be saying that, but this is my view. We created a business model that worked at the time, but to which, in a way, the customers are addicted to. You know, and I think it's in Spain. We tried a new business model where we're trying to dissociate the free subsidized handset with the communication. And it was failing really badly, and it didn't work. We were losing out in the market. So what do you do? Do you go back to doing what your competitors do, even though it's more sustainable, and then sink the company? That's what the customer does not like the idea of. I mean, I've got an iPhone 6. How much does it cost? £700, £800.
Yeah, we need some kind of an Uber idea of how to get out of that business model. And
I think SIM-only is a good thing because then people who look after their handsets.
Here on CSR Pod, we used to ask everyone actually the question of if you do talk about your mistakes and also talk about the mistakes outside of the company, because everything you hear, especially like a day like this, it's the success stories, how we did it, and this is the great things we are doing. And we say that it's so much to learn from mistakes. I mean, if you talk about children, when two parents meet, they always compare, you know, I did this and I did that. And if one parent all only talks about the success for the children, it's boring and you don't listen to it as long as you should. I mean, so it's a very powerful thing to be able to get experience from the mistakes. Mm-hmm. What is your experience of that?
In terms of sustainability or my career?
In sustainability.
Do you have any failure stories that you'd like to share with us?
I've got loads.
Are you able to select one of them?
I guess you don't share them.
Actually, my way of communicating is usually more to talk about the things that I'm probably not allowed to talk to on stage, so then waiting to be told off when I go back to the office. So the things which are, I would say, very difficult is that challenge of addressing, for me, my big bugbear, and I talked about it on a TED talk recently, is that binary thinking that companies have. On the one hand, companies are very good at doing philanthropy, very, very good at it, with millions and big projects and big PR and big marketing. On the other end, they're also very good at making lots of money in many different markets in very difficult situations and getting the volume and, you know, getting the shareholder to pay attention. But there is that space in the middle, which is the stuff that I personally work on, which is commercial innovation stuff, innovative stuff, which has commercial benefits on a different scale, but also delivers social good, but not in a philanthropic way. I'm very passionate about it. And it is very difficult in the business to find the right spot, because people revert very often to one or the other. Is it finding that middle ground of where is it going to stick? So that's still very challenging. It's challenging for me as I speak. So I've had loads of success. It's one little battle after one other that you win, but you never feel that you've won a war. And the war is a positive war. It's a war for good, but the war is never over. So yeah. So as I go back to the office tomorrow, I will still have the same challenges. They're still there.
But you're still in a good industry to actually find that space, because the space when it comes to telecommunication and building a good society, having information flow freely, should be there. Is that kind of...
So there's also a challenge, because a lot of the stuff that we do already has a good sustainability story naturally attached to it. So for example, and we're blessed with this, but it's also a curse at the same time. So we have something called mobile payment, M-Pesa. As I said earlier today, we transact about 47 billion euros every year through M-Pesa, which is the same as the ninth biggest company in the UK, And so we have a lot of positive stories about how mobile payments is changing access to financial services in emerging market, which is a great story, right? So the tendency for the business is maybe sometimes to think, well, hey, we're delivering the social good. Why do we need to do more? So where I come in is to get the company to innovate, to do new product and services for enterprise customers, products which make a big difference to how they operate. But the business tends to think, well, you know, how much, how quick?
Yeah.
And I said to them, listen, we're not giving away that for free. But the revenues or the volume generated through the services are more. I mean, we've got a huge company, so every innovation looks quite small in comparison. So there comes the challenge, basically.
Mm. You've got a really interesting job. I'm kind of envious. It sounds really fun.
Well, I love it. I still get up in the morning with a spring in my step. So yes.
When you turn for a source of inspiration, what, you know, boring gray day in the office when you really don't feel like being, you know, where would you turn?
Sounds a bit corny, and I can't even believe I'm saying that, but actually the best remedy is to go home and see your children, because they just don't care what you've been through the day, and they will basically tell you what happened in the playground. And you know, when is my next birthday party? Who's going to come to my next birthday party? And are we doing a cake this weekend? And it's all about them. And I think that's really refreshing. So that's the best cure.
I think it was very lovely. It wasn't corny at all. It was lovely. Thank you very much for being with
that's
us
okay.
and
Thank
talking
you.
To us. It was Thank enjoyable.
Mm. Good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.